This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations we want to have. The conversations we need to have.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. We will today be looking at the news that broke within the last hour. It's come. It's landed here. The latest deadly strain of bird flu has finally hit Victoria. What does this mean for you? Look, for all of us, it's going to affect all of us in some way. If you're an egg producer, a dairy producer, tell me how you've been preparing. Share those stories. It's been coming down the track for a while. Let me know how you've been preparing, how you're feeling on hearing this news today. If you're concerned about wildlife, we'll be listening to an expert on that, and tell me what you're thinking about hearing that news today. We'll get some information about what we need to know with bird flu finally here in Victoria. So stick around for that on The Conversation Hour and tell me what that information means for you. Also today, at what age should kids specialise in one sport if they are aspiring to a professional career? Are you one of those people who think, look, the earlier they commit to one sport, the better they're going to be, the more chance they've got in a really competitive environment, or not? What is the best age? Tell me maybe what you did as a kid and whether maybe playing more than one sport helped you with your one particular sporting love. If you've got a kid that's aspiring to be that professional footy player or basketball player or swimmer or whatever, what are you doing advising your child about that, especially if they're just obsessed in just doing the one thing? We're going to be looking into that and look at the expert advice for parents with kids with big sporting dreams. And also I'll be asking one of our most famous sprinters, Matt Shervington, about his views on this, what he did as a kid growing up, as well as also taking another moment to reflect on Tuesday night, possibly the biggest night of sprinting that Australia has ever seen. That's how it was described. That is, of course, the glorious night in Glasgow on the track. So you tell me what age you think you're advising, potentially, your kids should specialise in one sport if they are aspiring to a professional career. Also in The Conversation Hour, I just have to tell you about this. Stick around for the funniest story about a bad online review that I've ever heard. You need to stick around for that. It's hilarious. All that and more in The Conversation Hour. But next, bird flu is finally here in Victoria. What do we need to know?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Someone who's been covering this for quite some time now is Jane McNaughton, who's Ballarat rural reporter. You also might know Jane from The Country Hour. Jane, thank you so much for joining us this morning. What do you think will be the reaction this morning from the industry, from people who are really at the front row of this in our industries in Victoria?
We have been speaking to farmers about this already, Mary. It's obviously a developing situation and something that is definitely not welcome news to anyone in the poultry industry, also to anyone that is passionate about our environment and wildlife, because we know that it does affect poultry. It hasn't yet, just making it very clear, there is no detections in Australian agriculture of the H5 bird flu virus. But it is also absolutely devastating environmentally. We know that dairy cattle have got it in the US. We know that in other mammals, cats, dogs, dolphins, seals, tigers have even been affected, and some sheep. So it's going to have a really widespread effect across both agriculture and the environment as this scene develops.
And from people you've been speaking with, Jane, how well prepared are Victorian farmers? They've seen this before and they've seen this particular strain coming from the West. What would you say is their level of preparation?
Well, I know you'll be speaking with the Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group President Brian Ahmed in a second. We know that he says that this has been no surprise, because there has been a lot of work done by not only Agriculture Victoria but farmers on an individual level to try and protect their flocks from potential incursions of avian influenza. So if you're a free range producer, this is going to be a bit more scary than if you're a cage producer, because the way that avian influenza gets into a flock is by a chicken being in contact with a wild bird or an area in which a wild bird has been eating or drinking. So that's the way that farmers are preparing to try and keep their flocks away from wild migratory birds.
Jane, thank you for setting the scene so brilliantly there. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Jane McNaughton, ABC Rural Reporter. And as Jane said, I'm joined now by Brian Ahmed, who is from the Victorian Federation and an egg farmer as well, and the egg group president. Brian, thank you for joining me. As Jane was explaining there, it is going to hit particularly the free range producers. Can you tell me what your reaction is this morning to this news?
As farmers, we're concerned, of course. Every one of us, doesn't matter whether you're a cage, barn or a free-range farmer. And we've been preparing on farm for this. It's not unexpected. We were hit with a different strain of bird flu here in Victoria only a few years ago, and we learned a lot from the response at that time. So, like I said, we're prepared. We've got our biosecurity standards as high as we can have them. But of course, our free-range farmers are more susceptible because their birds are outside and they have the opportunity to mix with wild birds. And we know for a fact that they're the carriers of this virus.
Mm. Brian, I believe you're a caged egg farmer yourself. And when we look at the free-range sector there, which I can only presume, actually, you tell me, it has been a growing sector within Australian agriculture overall. As you say, is there absolutely no way? Obviously, free range leaves flocks vulnerable. There's been no way to protect birds in this industry.
Well, free range farmers can lock up their birds. I mean, we as farmers, we're responsible for our animals, so we've got to look after them. So if we have periods where there's high risk, whether it's because of weather or whether it's because of viruses, we lock them up for longer periods of time, and that's a way to try and avoid it. But at the end of the day, we have to let them out. So once we let them out, that biosecurity gets thrown out the window. We can't control wild birds. Now, I think yes, there has been a push towards free range over the past probably 10 or 15 years. People want more free-range eggs, so farmers have been producing them. But what people forget is we were all free-range when we went back, if we go back to the 1960s, and we got out of that farming system for a reason. We couldn't control disease then, and we can't control it now. It's just one of those things in an open environment that we can't control.
Just while we're on this point, and to sort of tease out that point, are you not suggesting that this would trigger a move back towards caged eggs, are you?
Oh, I don't think it'll trigger a move either way. I think we as an industry and also consumers here in Australia have to understand the importance of all our farming systems. We need a percentage of caged, a percentage of free range, and a percentage of barn. Mm. That way we can meet the diverse needs of the consumer and we can assure food safety and food security in this country.
Mm. Brian, you're listening to Brian Ahmed, who's an egg farmer in Western Victoria and also the current Victoria Farmer Federation Egg Group President. Brian, you mentioned consumers there. What might we see as a result of this bird flu strain coming to Victoria? Might we see shortages in the supermarkets?
Well, just at this stage, it's only in wild birds. So let's make it very clear. It hasn't hit any commercial flocks or
yes,
or
don't
even
want to
backyard
jump too many steps ahead.
That's right. But what we've been watching it closely, and originally it was in migratory birds, and that was a concern, but a very little concern for us. But now it's crossed into our local birds, so that's another step, right? Mm-hmm. But at this stage, we increase our biosecurity again, and we're aware of what's happening, but we're still not jumping to any conclusions. I think we're still pretty well prepared, and if it does hit a farm, a commercial farm, then we'll take our next steps that we need to do to try and minimise the impact it'll have on the industry.
Brian, what would happen or will happen potentially Not that I'm wishing it, but when it hits a commercial farm, what is the procedure from there in Victoria?
Well, here in Australia, the procedure is if we detect it on a commercial farm, that farm will be quarantined. Also, a 5-kilometre radius will go around that farm, so everything will be monitored, everything going in and out of that area will be. And if AgVic believe it's the right thing to do, then usually what happens is they cull everything on a farm. And then they will monitor, and if they believe it's spreading, they will start culling everything within the 5K zone. Because we found the best way to stop it from spreading is to basically eradicate farms.
Brian, just before I let you go, there's a certain level of realism, obviously, when with whatever you're doing as a farmer.
Yeah.
You've seen this come down the track, you've seen it before. Is there just that level of, you know, rolling up the sleeves, knowing what you have to do out there?
Yeah, no farmer wants to end up in that situation, but we know what has to be done at that level. But, I mean, we just, as an industry, we know what we need. Now, consumers have to start understanding that we can't produce all our eggs in free range. This is where our risk is coming. As our farms get bigger in the free range sector, our risk gets higher. It's basically a numbers game. So if we reduce the size of those farms and we have a percentage of our birds in cages and have a percentage of our birds in barn, then the risk in our free range is lower. But if we start to push all into that one farming system, our risk multiplies dramatically, right?
And to clarify, because I think that this is a point that people would want to hear what you really are saying, are you saying that we should keep that percentage as it is, or are you suggesting that that percentage should change and we should have less of a percentage of free-range eggs?
I think the consumer decides that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, we as farmers, we produce what the consumer wants, right? And I think the supermarkets are driving an agenda. They want to sell all free-range eggs. That seems to be their position. I think they need to reconsider their position and say, well, maybe we should have cage, barn and free-range on those shelves, and then the consumers can decide on what they buy. I don't think they should be pushing an industry into one farming system when we know the risks involved in that farming system.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today in the Conversation Hour.
Thank you very much.
That's Brian Ahmed from the Victorian Farmers Federation. I'll bring in here Ewan Ritchie, who is Professor of Wildlife Ecology at Deakin. And Ewan, we've been speaking about bird flu with you before, this particular strain, how long it would take. You've just listened to Brian there talking about the fact that, look, it isn't in the commercial farms yet. What we do know is that this first confirmed case, is in a greater crested tern, a local seabird found at Portland. What's your estimation of how quickly or slowly this strain will travel from that bird, if you like, to commercial farms?
Yeah, look, good morning, Mary. It's really hard to know exactly how quickly it's going to spread, and terns themselves are unlikely to be interacting with chickens. But I guess the concern is, of course, that the terns have probably been in contact with other wild birds. And at some point, presumably, one of those wild birds will, you know, move into an area where there's probably free-range chickens. So it's probably, unfortunately, a matter of when, not if. Of course, we all hope that we don't see the worst of what's happened in other parts of the world, but we are seeing increasing numbers of cases of bird flu being detected across different parts of Australia, and we would expect to see even more cases in the future, and unfortunately associated with that, large deaths of birds, both wild but also in some cases, chickens, mm-hmm. livestock, and of course mammals as well, native mammals.
Yes, and I want to ask you about beyond the farms, but is there a window or a time frame that you would guesstimate, or is that just simply too hard
It's really hard to, to guess, and I certainly wouldn't want to put a date on that. But I think, obviously, the most important thing is that we're being vigilant. We have surveillance and monitoring in place. And, of course, as always, if people see sick, dead wildlife or wildlife that's behaving erratically or strangely, they should report it to the officials as soon as possible and certainly not come into contact or try and touch or, you know, move those wildlife.
You're listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We're talking about the breaking news this morning that there has been the first detection of the H5N1 strain. That's the latest very deadly avian influenza strain in Victoria. Ewan Ritchie is with me. Tell me, Ewan, we've been talking about other wildlife concerns. What are your greatest concerns now in Victoria now that we have this detected?
I think we have concerns for all wildlife, especially, of course, birds, because they are so vulnerable to this pathogen, but so are many mammal species. And I think, you know, we're immediately concerned about threatened species and species that have small distributions. So whether in the case of birds, that's things like the regent honeyeater, the orange-bellied parrot, the swift parrot, which are all threatened species. But of course, with mammals, you know, we're concerned about the dingo, which is found both in eastern Victoria, but a small population in the northwest of the state. We think potentially fewer than 100 adults left. Bandicoots, which will eat dead birds, quolls in northeast Victoria, and even marine mammals, which we know are highly susceptible and have suffered, you know, deaths in the thousands in some cases in other parts of the world. The Burunun dolphin, which is a species of bottlenose dolphin that's only found in Port Phillip Bay and in the Gippsland Lakes, and we think that probably there's less than 300 of those in the world left. You know, if they come into contact in areas where they're sick seabirds and contract the virus themselves, this would be a massive concern. So, and then, of course, you know, you think about the flow and effects to ecosystems as well. If we're having, you know, large deaths of birds, you know, that's going to be polluting water in some cases, but also animals will be eating those dead carcasses, and they themselves then can contract the virus and potentially die as well.
Ewan, thank you so much for joining us. We will keep across this story on The Conversation Hour. There are many questions that people will have as this progresses, hopefully in a slow manner. Thank you for your expertise.
Thanks, Mary.
Ewan Ritchie is Professor of Wildlife Ecology at Deakin. Coming up in The Conversation Hour, please stay with me. I'm going to cross to the US for one of the funniest bad review stories I've ever heard, and also the genius response from the company involved. But next, let's talk about the magical night this week on the track in Glasgow.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Look, we talk up a lot our glorious performance in the Commonwealth Games, and we are certainly walking the walk this week. But this Games seems really special when it comes to the track. Tuesday night in particular featured two national 100-metre records, men's and women's, being smashed. To give you a little bit of a reminder of what happened with Lachlan Kennedy, one of these, this is him shattering the Australian men's 100-metre record.
Lockie's in the mix. It's Lachlan Kennedy in the jade. Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy. Oh, SME got him on the line, I think. It is oh so close. I think he might have just got Lachlan. Lachlan had it until the absolute last gasp.
Well, that was Bruce, of course, and in the team with Bruce is Matt Shervington. He's a Sunrise co-host, and you know him also as the Olympic sprinter and also the primetime host of Seven's Commonwealth Games coverage. Shervo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mary.
Yes, look how familiar I was.
Listening to that. That was so good. What a special moment. And you were so right in your introduction, right across the board. On our Commonwealth Games team, we are just lighting up the world, 47 gold medals now, 103 medals in total. And yes, those two 100 national records, just incredible. Tori Lewis in the women's, and then Lachie has done something that is pretty special. It's put us on the map, not just obviously as a national record, Oceania record, area record, but if you add his 985 that he ran to get that silver medal in that final.
Yep.
with Gout Gout's 1967 that he ran in the 200 metres at the National Championships earlier this year. It puts us as a powerhouse of men sprinting internationally, the fourth fastest nation. And the ones in front of us are pretty good. So Jamaica, USA and Canada are the only three nations that have both 100 and 200 metre national record better than ours, which is incredible. We are punching well above our weight.
Absolutely extraordinary. So yes, his time was 9.85. He beat Patrick Johnson's record that had stood for, what was it, 20 years?
And 23 years.
23
yeah.
years. And it was described on the night, I think Bruce McAvaney said something like, this could have been our most glorious night in Australian sprinting. How well does it set us up for the Olympics coming up? What does it mean for us there? Is it a podium finish for Kennedy and others potentially?
Yeah, well, what Lockie has done, he's put himself 100% in the mix for medals at any major championship. And you're right. I mean, we've got LA 2028 coming up, but of course, so many of us are looking forward 6 years to the 2032 Games in Brisbane, which is a very special thing as an athlete to be able to say, I competed at a home Olympic Games. And Lockie will certainly have that opportunity. He's 22 years of age. He'll be 28 by the time those games come around, and there's a lot of racing for him to do in between, and essentially he'll be in his prime. And then couple that with some of our other sprinters as well, and then Tory's very similar and spent a lot of time in Brisbane and Queensland, and she too will be in her prime. So
well, I mean, and she broke records one night after the other. In fact, let's have a little listen to Tory Lewis speaking after her bronze medal win in the 100 metres when she broke her own record from the night before to break that 11 seconds mark.
You know, I was hoping I got a medal, but I didn't want to, like, celebrate too early just in case I got fourth or something else. But, yeah, when I saw my name on the screen, I was super happy. And then even more happy with the 10.99.
And then even more happy. What's her trajectory looking like, Matt?
Yeah, so she has just broken the 11-second mark, which is kind of on par with the 10-second mark in the men's, the first ever Australian to do it. She went 10.99, and I can personally tell you that 0.01 of a second is career-changing. It really does give you the confidence to think, well, I can be in the mix with the best in the world at any major championship in the world. The amazing thing with Tory is that's the fifth time she's broken the national record, but this year alone, she's broken it three times. The first time was a week ago. The second time was in the semi-finals two nights ago. And then she broke it again in the final. So to have a trajectory like that just in a small window of time is phenomenal. She's moved to the Netherlands. She's training over there with an amazing one-lap runner, 400-metre runner called Femke Bol. And she's now within a really good quality squad, really good coaching, really good training partners. She's put herself in arguably the fastest women's European sprint group over there. So I think she's a real, she's intelligent about it. She's focused on not just what happens tomorrow, but what happens 2 years down the track, 4 years down the track. And that's a pretty special thing to have. Lockie's the same. Lockie's very intelligent. His coach, Andrew Island, who is a super quiet guy, no one, I'm sure, even knows his name. He has masterfully prepared Lockie for these Commonwealth Games to the second. But the thing with Lockie that proves the difference for most people, there's two types of one percenters, in my opinion. There's the input one percenters, that's the hard work, the dedication, the consistency, all the things that you talk about in a footy team and all of that. But then there's a 1%, which is output, which is the difference is it's your temperament. It's you and understanding the moment and capturing that moment and executing in that moment. That's what Lockie does so beautifully.
Yeah, just rising to the pressure. Talking of pressure, Cam Myers has qualified in the men's mile. For people who don't know, they scrapped the 1,500 metres this time just as a bit of a sentimental pushback for the mile. And in terms of pressure, well, he's up against Scotland's pin-up boy of the Games, isn't he? How much pressure and what can he do?
I'll tell you what, if you watched Cam Myers last night and his post-race interview, you would not know he's under any pressure. He is supremely confident, supremely comfortable in his own skin. You talk about a student of the sport. That is him. He lives and breathes it. His whole team does. He strategizes. He works hard. He's only 20 years of age, but he has a really mature head on his body. You're right. I mean, what Josh Kerr did, so 17 times the mile record had been broken over the last 45 years by 12 men. It took 27 years then to break it again. Josh Kerr did that only a couple of weeks ago in London, and he wants to win. He's Scottish. He wants to win at his home track. He said, I know this track better than anyone. It's a track where you can be windswept, sunburnt and soaked by the end of one race. He understands it. He wants to do it. He got the crowd going in the heats yesterday. He would love a gold medal at these games. But Cam Myers is on that growth trajectory, that evolution of a young athlete where you just don't know what is around the corner. Yeah. Another big breakthrough. And if that comes at the right time, in the right strategic race, which could be that final on Saturday morning, it would be amazing.
So many highlights from these games that we can't cover them all. Someone's talking about, of course, the golds in the women's and men's 10K runs. Of course, a shout out there to Kai Robertson, Eleanor Patterson. But before I let you go, Matt, we are going to be talking later about what age kids should be starting to specialise in a sport if they do have those big dreams of being professional. So I just wanted to ask you before I let you go, in your life, what was that? When did you start really concentrating on athletics? And what would you say now?
We're very lucky in Australia because we have this kids competition called Little Athletics, which is a national program that's been around for years and years and years and years. And you can go through a whole host of not just track and field athletes that have gone through, but also other sports athletes that have been through. Sam Kerr is one that, off the top of my head. Josh Hazlewood still holds records. We've got footy players that still hold records at that Little Athletics level. And they find, I think the coolest thing about that is you find your area of skill, whether it's the throws, the jumps, the sprints or the longer distance. I would highly encourage anyone in any sport to use that as a foundation.
Until teenage years, do you think?
Yeah, well, it goes up to about 15 years of age, depending on kind of where you are on the cutoff. And I think that's enough to be able to, and I wouldn't ever restrict myself to, or even my own kids to one sport. I think experimenting with so many other great sporting organisations that we've got available to us is awesome. You know, the likes of Auskick and the netball programs and whatever it is, school sport. Dip your toe in, have a go. You'll find your area. You'll find your people. You'll find your space. And we're very lucky in this country that we don't restrict it. I mean, even the Winter Olympics earlier in this year is a great example of that.
Yes.
We are open to trying new things, to giving ourselves the best chance to perform on the world stage or even the club stage, you know, the weekend warrior stage. So I did Little Athletics very early on, under nines, I think was my first kind of try at it. I didn't like it. I moved to other sports. I played cricket and baseball over the summertime. I played everything from rugby, league and soccer. Never played AFL and I'm sure that all of my friends would bag me about that.
But then found your way back with a degree of success.
Yeah, and I think that at the end of the day is if it brings you back and you enjoy doing it, go and do it. It's a vital part of our way of life, being out there on the sporting field and enjoying company of our teammates.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the rest of the games and the commentary. Really wonderful to have you on the program.
Nice one. Thanks, Mary.
That's Matt Shervington. He is Sunrise co-host. He's primetime host of these Commonwealth Games coverage. And thanks to Channel 7 there for the audio that we did use as well. And just remember that, yes, you can see the games free and on demand and live as well, 7 Plus Sport. Catch up with it on the ABC platforms as well, of course. Now, coming up on the Conversation Hour, we will a little later be talking about the science and the expert advice behind what age you do have kids specialise. We will delve a little bit more into that. But I want to know from you, do you leave reviews online? Why do you leave them? Do you leave particularly nasty ones? Do you read the reviews? Does it mean much to you? I want to hear about that because coming up, We'll be crossing to the States to hear firsthand one of the funniest responses to a bad review that I've ever heard.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Do you leave bad reviews? Have you left them? Do they influence you? Do you read the reviews, good or bad, before you go somewhere, before you go to a restaurant? Tell me about your relationship with reviews. Do you trust them? My next guest is going to tell you about a very funny story about one review that has left actually her business, well, world famous. Amanda McMullen is president of the New Bedford Whaling Museum in Massachusetts. I was practicing that too, Amanda, and joins me now. Hello.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm just going to set you up here. Obviously, the Whaling Museum is, as it sounds, a place where you go to see bones of whales. Is this correct?
You've got it. We've got five whale skeletons, actually four suspended from our ceiling and one right at eye level for you when you come in.
Right. Tell us about the one-star review you got in 2020.
Yeah, it's a great story. You know, height of the pandemic and the review popped up and our team, of course, noticed it immediately because that stands out. And honestly, we got the biggest chuckle out. I'm not sure if it was upset with us or had a terrible experience, but regardless of what was behind it, we thought it was so funny. And it has become kind of what we call a family joke for years. And a couple years ago, one of our staff members who oversees our front store, Emily Rosno, kept saying, you know, I think we could do something with this. I think we just can't let this be an internal joke.
Amanda, I'm so sorry. I think our phone line might have actually crackled if you actually had said what the review said.
Yeah.
So just for people who might not know, the one-star review said that it was the worst aquarium that they'd ever seen.
You got it, Mary. I jumped right over the story. It was one star, worst aquarium ever, which really, just as you're doing, made us laugh so hard because we're not an aquarium at all. We are, in fact, a historical society.
So someone has walked in. Someone has walked in looking for the whales, swimming about, apparently, yes. And thought, hang
that's
on.
Right. That's right, and just sort of said, we've now found out it was a complete joke, and we just found that out this week. It was a high school student, as a matter of fact, who was, you know, pranking and having fun. But at the time, we had no idea what the origin of this was.
So do you think that it was a joke?
It was a big laugh. That's what they say today. I will say local reporters have found them, and that's what they have indicated at this point, that they were just doing teenage pranks, and it was a lot of fun, and all that sort of, you know, shenanigans, if you will.
It even works as a joke, though, doesn't it, to talk about a museum as the worst aquarium you've ever seen?
The funniest thing ever, yeah.
It's great. Did anyone from the museum actually hop online and try and engage, or were you just too busy rolling around?
No, never did. And really, we were never sort of, we didn't dwell on it. We, like I said, we always thought it was so funny, and it was truly an internal joke for such a long period of time. But we didn't dwell on it. We sort of moved on. We weren't wounded by it. We all kind of laughed at it for years. And then, like I said, we decided to throw it on some merchandise and thought, well, let's lean into this. This is pretty funny.
I want to hear from people, 1300-222-774. Have you left bad reviews and have you got results from that? Or if you are like me, I don't have the energy to write reviews, but I do like reading them. But do I trust them? 1300-222-774. Amanda McMullen is with us from the US. She is president and CEO of the New Bedford Whaling Museum that turned a potentially facetious online bad review into great merch. So tell us about this merch, Amanda. I can see a photo of it here. You basically, you've got one star out of five saying worst aquarium ever. How popular is this merch?
Oh, I mean, it's off the shelf. And so honestly, we did it, Mary, last fall. We launched it for kind of our holiday shopping season. And we have, if you can imagine, an annual Moby Dick marathon celebrating Herman Melville's tale that happens every January. And so the shirts did incredibly well last holiday and through the marathon itself, and it immediately became one of our top sellers. And then if you fast forward to the spring, we had always dreamed of putting in, I wouldn't really call it an aquarium, but a fish tank, if you will, because we want to talk about kind of the coastal environment.
So wait a minute, you may actually make it into an aquarium from here. It's given you an idea.
Well, we've got it's a really lovely fish tank, I will say, and it has a couple puffer fish and starfish and whatnot. And so that's what got this going again, is we posted another picture of the shirts and said, well, this is awkward because now we do have a fish tank and we are an aquarium, if you will. So we continue to have fun with it. And that is what launched a couple weeks ago that really picked up unbelievable traction here in the States and is now, I will say, spreading throughout the whole world. So we are getting orders from all over the globe and having a lot of fun as we fill these orders and excited to connect people with the New Bedford Whaling Museum.
And a lesson in how to respond to reviews. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Amanda McMullen from the New Bedford Whaling Museum, which is the worst aquarium ever. We wanted to talk about bad reviews and how you react to them as a consumer and how companies actually respond to them as well. Tell me, 1300 222 774, do you trust reviews? Are you a chronic reviewer online? Let me know. Gary Mortimer is Professor of Marketing and Consumer Behaviour at the Queensland University of Technology and looks at this sort of thing. Gary, is that example basically the how to respond to, let's assume it might have been a sincere and misguided online review?
It's a great yarn, and I think this is a great example of a really savvy business turning a negative review into a funny or clever marketing strategy. And I'm up here in Brisbane, and there's a particular steak restaurant in Brisbane. It has big billboards around Brisbane, and it says, voted Brisbane's worst vegetarian restaurant. And it's so clever how a business will see a review and will actually use it to actually create, a bit of momentum and coverage.
So it may be these jokes, of course, but there are genuine bad reviews. What have you seen in your research about the psychology of how companies respond to bad reviews?
Yeah, listen, I think we've probably all seen those signs often in the front of cafes or say, you know, come in and try Australia's worst coffee voted by Karen One Star. The psychology behind it is rather than defending it, it's actually about saying, hey, listen, you know, we're pretty confident in our coffee or our museum or our restaurant, and we're so confident we're actually going to highlight these negative reviews and encourage you through curiosity to actually come in and make that decision for yourself, make that judgment for yourself. The other thing is, I think Aussies just love that idea of self-deprecating humour. So we can laugh at ourselves, and a business that's happy to laugh at itself or, you know, it tends to sort of humanise and connect well. And at the end of the day, it's very much about authenticity. So I'm pretty sceptical when I see a restaurant or a resort and it's only got 5-star reviews.
Yes.
You kind of think, well, come on, there's got to be a couple of ones in there somewhere. So if you see that nice balance and the business highlights the 1 or 2-star reviews, it actually creates a little authenticity.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Gary Mortimer, who's from the Queensland University of Technology. Tell me about whether you leave reviews, good or bad. Do you make a point of doing it? Do you trust them? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Gary, as you say, you are looking as a consumer at the reviews, and there is this issue of trust. You've pointed to there. You need to have those bad reviews as part of it. Is there a wider sort of industry behind posting reviews on competitors' websites or about culling the bad ones from the websites?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been a little bit of anecdotal evidence around sort of the strategies that some businesses will use, either competitive strategies, and these are not positive strategies, but strategies where they'll have, workers or family members identify a competitor down the road who will then, go out of their way to sort of list, very negative one or two star reviews. And that's not a particularly a positive approach or a positive long-term strategy, but there's some discussions around that. There's also been probably more recently some queries around international players who will place large volumes of one-star reviews onto a business and then sort of almost extort some cash or some money from them to say, listen, we'll remove them if you make this payment. So there are some scrupulous ways that some of these players will engage with reviews. And ultimately, it's a very strong mechanism. As consumers, we all do this. Before we buy a new TV, go to a new restaurant, visit a new hotel or resort, we tend to look at those reviews. So reviews tend to be quite authentic and more trusted and reliable than, say, marketing claims. You'd expect a good restaurant to say we're the best restaurant in Sydney or Melbourne, but to actually see those reviews and believe that they're true tends to give them more credit and reliability.
Dax, you've called in from Carlton North. You leaving a review at the moment, I believe.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, it was a bit surreal. I didn't know you were talking about this, and I was actually writing a review, which I hardly ever do. Like, I've maybe written like two reviews in my whole life. But I had a really good experience at a bike shop, I just thought, oh yeah, maybe I'll just leave a nice review. I think leaving a bad review can absolutely destroy a business. And I don't know what the intention is to do that. I don't know. I mean, it's just. It's kind of a little bit up in the air for me.
But you wanted to be kind.
I don't think I would leave a bad review even if I didn't enjoy a service or something. I just wouldn't go there again.
Because there is a lot of power.
That's just me.
That's right. Consumers have been given a lot of power compared to the old times by, having all this available to us, Dax. And so that's interesting. What was the thing that pushed you towards leaving a positive review?
Well, I had a bike repair, and then a day later the tyre popped again. And so I took it back, and they didn't really have to replace the tyre again or replace the tube in my bike, but they did it anyway.
But they did it. Oh, yeah. Dax, that is lovely to hear that you have that service and lovely that you had that response as well. Gary Mortimer, that is potentially a lovely note to end on. Just be kind with all these reviews, potentially. There are consequences.
Listen, absolutely. And product reviews or service reviews are a product of expectation. If the business exceeds your expectation, you're more likely to provide a positive review. But also, the negative stuff, they'd have to do something pretty bad to warrant a one or two star review.
Gary, thank you for joining us today. Gary Mortimer is Professor of Marketing and Consumer Behaviour at Queensland University of Technology. Someone else is also saying, look, I tend to look at the worst ones and realise that generally they're almost attempting to destroy a business for petty reasons. I need to read this one out from Eddie. Bad reviews can be so funny. In a somewhat similar vein to our guest before from Massachusetts, condom vending machines graffitied with, "This is the worst chewing gum I've ever tasted." Eddie, thank you for your contribution as well. This is The Conversation Hour, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up next, tell me about the young ambitious kid in your life, the one who wants to become that professional sports person. What are you doing in terms of advising when they should start to specialise? We'll talk to an expert.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
1300 222 774. If you were a kid who specialised too early, if you actually had a lot of experience in different sports, like Matt Shervington, who we interviewed earlier, and then went on to glory in professional sport, tell me what age you think kids should be specialising. We are now being joined by an expert who can tell you about what age it is. Carl Woods, Associate Professor of Skill Acquisition at the University of Queensland. Thank you so much for joining me, Carl.
No worries at all, Mary. Thanks for having me.
It seems like we've been talking about this for a while, to protect not just the bodies but also the minds of young, ambitious sports people. But every generation will have young, ambitious kids who just want to be the best and the professional best. What is your overall advice as to the age where kids should start to specialise?
Yeah, it is an age-old question, you know, and it's a tough one too that parents, particularly here in Australia, face all the time. And for me, it fundamentally comes back to one of the most profound parts, why they got into sport at the start. And oftentimes it's for the love of playing a particular activity, playing with their friends, playing with their mates, enjoying their weekends filled with these particular activities. And we have this rush to professionalize and get them to undertake highly specialized training as early as possible. And a lot of that stems from this kind of myth that the more we practice a particular activity over and over again, so highly repetitious practice, the better we get at it. And to be honest, there's growing evidence that suggests that's actually not the case. And almost counterintuitively to that initial thought, some of the world's best athletes in a particular sport have diversified in a lot of different sports for a lot longer than others who specialized in a particular sport that didn't quite make it to that elite level. So my general rule of thumb is play as many different sports with as much levels of enjoyment as you possibly can. And usually the evidence shows us that around the age of 16, that's when our summer and winter sports tend to become year-long through the specialised training that can occur over those pre-season stages. But around that 16, 17 years of age is maybe when we should start to consider the specialisation, and that's when we start to see the maturational and psychological components start to stabilise just a little bit at least.
So 16, you're saying, is the earliest, or what would I know it would be different with different sports potentially, but what are the ages you're talking about?
Yeah, primarily what we know is with team invasion sports, so our footballs, basketballs, netballs, children that tend to play a lot of different sports up till the age of 16 tend to thrive for a lot longer in those particular invasion sports that they choose.
Sure I've heard that before.
Yeah, like our court or our field invasion sports, like our basketballs, our footballs, our soccers, these types of sports. And kids that play a whole variety of those different types of sports actually get a whole heap of different skills that transfer into those, or one or two of those particular sports. And we tend to see that reach its peak at about 16 years of age. So I tend to think, based on our research and a growing amount of research across the world in a variety of different sports, 16, 17 is about the age that we'd really like to start to specialise in one or two particular sports. But up until that point, as many different sports as the child and the parents can manage is probably a good start.
What about other sports then? Maybe solo sports where you're not talking about that interaction and those skills?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we tend to find there's this belief that the earlier that they can specialise in those sports, the more training that they can get in. And that is true to a degree. But we tend to see high levels of dropout, high attrition levels, burnout, injury that occur quite early, and very early retirement ages. So we tend to see, particularly in gymnastics and these highly individualised sports, we see these athletes retiring early 20s or potentially late teens because they've been participating in these sports for so long.
So are you saying that even for those solo sports, so I'm thinking, well, it could be athletics, it could be tennis, it could be any of those things, you should also be thinking about the age of 16?
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely agree. And there's growing evidence to suggest the transfer of skills might not just be physical, but things like psychological skills in terms of being comfortable with that level of competitiveness and competition that they can accrue from other particular activities. But absolutely, I think the later we can specialise, generally the evidence shows the more sustained success that we can see, but also the sustained love that we see. I mean, the last thing we want is to hyper specialise very early and children fall out of love with the sport because it becomes too serious too quickly. At the end of the day, we need to hold open opportunities for kids to still be kids. And then if they start to show particular predispositions or skill sets in a particular sport, we nurture that as best we can whilst also holding open opportunities for them to diversify as well. We've got some great evidence, even quite unique in trampoline, for example. Trampolinists that engage in other activities outside of sport, things like photography or cinematography, actually thrive quite well in those sports because they're fostering other interests that bites into their training time. So it's a careful balance, but
so that's not that just sorry, my mind was boggling there. Obviously, yeah. It's not about the skills; it's about the mindset being expanded. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Exposure to different experiences is critical. We know that in youth sport, not just in other sports, but exposure to a whole variety of different domains as well is essential to helping more what we refer to as holistic or a greater ecology of development.
Carl, thank you so much for joining us today.
No worries at all. Thank you.
Carl Woods from the University of Queensland. Well, there you go, 14 or 16, potentially the magic number there. Pete in Frankston South, what do you think?
I played softball from 10 till 14. Mm. And then when we got to 14, it was like an easy transition into baseball, especially down the peninsula from Frankston up to, like Moorabbin.
And so did you play lots of other sports as well before you specialised?
Of course. Yeah. Like when I was 7, I played basketball for our primary school until whatever. It just because you're young doesn't mean like you don't have exposure to other sports.
Yeah, that's right. And it can actually help you. Pete, thank you for your thoughts. And also we've been talking about the glorious Commonwealth Games, in particular our sprinters. Ian in Stawell, what do you think about, especially our national record holders?
Well, I think it actually runs across the previous topic of being good role models. I think they were just so joyous. They didn't have to win. They were just happy about participating. And
the record, you're talking about Lockie and Torrey. Yep.
Yeah. And just a bit of background, and I'm not the expert in this, but Lockie Kennedy came to the Stawell Gift a couple of years ago, and he was just so good with kids and so authentic. And it would make any young kid want to keep up the sport. So I think one of the things that kids have got to be is good role models for the future. And Gout was the same, just fantastic.
Absolutely. Ian, so well said. That's what we want, isn't it? The kids to at least be well-rounded along the way to their sporting glory. Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. You can listen to all of this again if you go onto the ABC Listen app, and you can just look up Conversation Hour. Also, any suggestions of what we should cover, conversationhour@abc.net.au is the email. Talk soon.